Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. So without further ado, allow me to introduce our fantastic guest. Rachel Roberts is the founder of American Nun, the N-O-N-E, not American Nun, like a bad habit type of thing. American Nun is the first organization of its kind to serve the fastest growing non-religious demographic in our country, the nuns. She is the author of Confessions of an American Nun, a credo of sorts. She's deeply motivated to help elevate the soul of our nation and believes that the United States and believes that collectively nuns harness a vast power to do so. The study of religion has been her passion since young adulthood. She has a bachelor's degree with an emphasis on philosophy of religion and a master's degree in theological studies from Southern Methodist University. She grew up in a Christian cult, which I'm looking forward to hearing about. With her mother, but her father was an atheist, which again, I'm looking forward to hearing about. After an on-again, off-again relationship with Christianity as an adult, Rachel found her truth and freedom in coming out as a nun. She has three children, a dog named Tito, a cat named Strudel, and her guilty pleasures include gummy bears, which I totally agree with, a crisp IPA, and Star Trek. So Rachel, welcome to RFRX. How are you doing today?
I'm awesome, Eric. I could not be more exhilarated to share some time with just this incredible energy of all the people here this evening. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I was going to say, it's wonderful to have you. That's all I was going to say.
Thank you.
Yeah, we have got well over 90 people kind of between the two, Discord and here, like just tuning in live, and I'm looking forward to seeing having all these other people tune in and get to meet you as well. So Rachel, you talked about being raised in a cult. So tell us a little bit about that.
Oh boy, there's so much to tell. I always like to lead with the notion that I was not raised in one of the sexier cults. So we didn't sacrifice chickens and we didn't marry all 6-year-olds. I know. It was kind of more of a sleepy kind of cult in that sense. So don't know that they're going to make a Netflix series out of this particular cult. But the truth of the matter is that the type of cult that I grew up in is, I consider, in some ways more insidious and more dangerous than the ones that make all the headlines, because they fly under the radar, doing a great deal of damage to people, particularly vulnerable people like children and single mothers, which is how my mom got involved in this cult. And when it's, you know, if you're not sacrificing chickens and marrying off 6-year-olds, then nobody's really paying attention. They just go, well, those are those kind of those weird people over there, but they just kind of, you know, turn the other way and go on about their business. And so it took me a while to start to realize the gravity of what I experienced as a kid. And when I studied religion in my undergraduate degree, I did a research paper on cults, and that's when my mind kind of went, oh, dang, you know what I mean? So,
yeah. Yeah. One of the things that when I hear cult, I think of like the compound in Waco where they've amassed guns and they've kind of isolated themselves. Or I think of a controlling charismatic leader who gets in a shitload of trouble with like sex stuff. Or I think of Georgetown, where people drank all the Kool-Aid and died. Like, that's kind of what I think of as cults. Jonestown, not Georgetown, Jonestown.
I know what you meant. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
well, you know, there was a name. What was unique about this cult is that it was a network of home churches. So it wasn't a singular place with a singular leader, although there were a group of 5 men at the top. And so the title that I provided, the Amway of Cults, it really was structured similar. And I'm not trying to disparage Amway. I'm staying neutral on that subject, but the structure was very similar to Amway, and where there were just a handful of people at the top, and they literally had a pyramid system where everybody had to have a shepherd. So the name of this cult was called the Shepherding Movement. It was a network of home churches that spread out throughout the Southern United States. And this was, would you like a little brief history? I'm assuming you don't mind if I go into this.
Heck yeah, I am fascinated. But first off, you're kidding me. There was five men leading this? That's like so unlike any other cult or religion I've ever heard of. That sounds really unique.
Can we say naughty words on this program?
Fuck yeah, we can.
Okay, you can, yeah.
You can swear all the fuck you want, Rachel. Go right ahead.
I just imagine it was just like one big circle jerk at the top, right? I mean, they're all just like bit each other off and
let's hope they weren't selling that stuff.
Well, they weren't selling that stuff, but you know what I mean? That is what it was in terms of their ego and the power trip and so forth. And anyway, so I'll back up now that I got to get the raunchiness out. But this movement originated in the early 70s when the hippie culture of the late 60s had caused a lot of young adults at the time to basically defect from traditional religion at the time. And many of those hippies just left religion altogether, but some decided to basically say, I'm going to take this hippie culture, but do it for Jesus. And so I'm sure you guys have heard the term Jesus freaks. And so that's where that kind of Jesus freak culture started to crop up in our culture in the late 60s. And so in the early 70s, there were these five men who met in Fort Lauderdale, and they are called the Fort Lauderdale Five. You can Google them. And, they were like, hey guys, they're Christians, evangelical Christians. And they're like, hey, listen, we got a problem. All these young people are leaving the church, which we kind of think is cool, but they don't have any structure or any guidance, or the word they like to use was any shepherding to, you know, bring them on the path of being a Christian. And so these guys concocted this plan where they started all these home churches where everybody had to have a shepherd. They took some Bible verse, and I should know by now which one it is, but it always escapes me. But they misappropriated some Bible verse that basically says, you know, that everybody should have a shepherd. And so naturally only men qualify as shepherds. And so these five guys had people underneath them that they shepherded. And then though that tier had people under them that they shepherded, and it just kind of went down and down and down. But the cool thing for the guys at the top was that everybody tithed upward. So
of course.
Yeah. Right.
This is definitely a pyramid scheme, multi-level marketing.
Like I said, the Amway of cults. Yeah. I mean, it was like,
instead of like protein shakes, you get souls.
And the higher you
person at the top gets the most souls.
Most money. And so the guys at the top, you know, had the nicer houses and the nicer cars, but that's because God, you know, blessed them. I don't know that it was called the prosperity gospel at the time, but it was certainly a precursor to it without question, because it was the whole name it and claim it, you know, kind of thing. But the fiscal, you know, misappropriations in that dynamic obviously were benefited those at the top the most, but I don't consider that to be the worst grievance of that group at all, because clearly what we're talking about here is a power structure. And so anytime you have a power structure like this, there are ripe opportunities for abuse. And so you can just name, you can say, if you can think of it, you know, it happened. And so these shepherds, you always had a male shepherd. So I was a female child. So my shepherd was my stepfather, you mentioned my dad was an atheist. So my mom and my father divorced when I was very young. And so my mom, as a single mother, got involved in this cult. And then that's when my stepfather became my shepherd. And so as my shepherd, as a six-year-old kid, he was the voice of God. So he channeled God to me.
That's so not only was it like a multi-level marketing of like the money would go to the top, but the voice of God would travel down through these
the shepherd
lines. Oh, geez, Louise.
Yeah. So you didn't have direct, as a female, you didn't have direct communication with God. And so whoever your shepherd was would have the power to come to you and say, God told me X, Y, Z, you know. So what are you laughing at, Eric?
Okay. All right.
Go Rachel, ahead.
I'm so sorry. Last week we had in a very innocent boat metaphor that turned into some incredibly clever boat puns. And the chat is just going off with these dumb boat puns. And I'm so sorry. I was reading the chat and a boat pun came through. I'm really, really sorry.
That's serious.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So, how did they get to talk to God, or like just because they said it, or was there some sort of ceremony or something? Like, this just seems totally random as a person who could channel the God.
No, all you had to do is read the epistles of Paul and see that, you know, women didn't have the same type of authority as men did. And so it was basically just opportunistic patriarchy at the end of the day, really. Jeez. So, but then if you take that structure and you couple it with someone who is by nature an abuser, then it's even a million times worse. I'm still friends with some kids that I grew up with. I mean, they're not kids anymore, but, and they were not as damaged as I was because they had good parents who just happened to get swept up in a really bad ideology. And then since they left, you know what I mean? So it just kind of, there were different shades of this, but I knew of some, people who were gay, who were traumatized severely because the shepherd would tell the person, you know, you can't wear your hair that way. You have to wear makeup. Wow. You have to, you know, wear heels and carry a purse and, you know, just try to make somebody be somebody that they weren't. And, but in the case of the way my brother and I grew up, it was just a lot of abuse in the name of God.
So would they read the Bible a certain way and then say that God was talking to them based on the interpretation of the Bible, or was it very like arbitrary? And they say like, you know, God told me that you can't wear your hair this way. Was it just like a pick and choose kind of thing?
Yeah, it always is, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, really. And so, you know, we played Russian roulette with the Bible where, you know, you would close your eyes and like flip it and then do that and, you know, and see what the message was for the day or whatever. And I would sweat bullets that what if I land in like Leviticus or Deuteronomy?
I know, right.
Like, shit. It's kind of how a lot of other churches operate, but on steroids, you know. So that's where the question of what is a cult versus what isn't a cult kind of comes into play, because one of the key differences that I identified when I did my research into cults, this was back in the early 90s, but was that a cult is not fully upfront with everything that they are going to ask you to believe or do. And so they coax you in before they reveal, you know, all these other requirements, Whereas you could go to the Methodist church down the street and they're very transparent about what they believe and how they function and all that. And so that's one of the big differences, you know, between the experience that I had or that type of cult, as well as just the abuse and so forth. But, you know, here's the thing. You don't have to be raised in a religious cult to be abused, obviously. But the difference is when you are taught to believe that there is a supreme God floating out in the sky somewhere who controls everything and who tells, you know, your stepfather that you cheated on a test today, so therefore I'm going to beat you, you know, then you don't know, like when I chose to leave, I left home when I was 16. And when I chose to leave to go live with my atheist father, I might add, I firmly believed that I was standing up against the God of the universe.
Wow. Like so, that's incredibly courageous to just like thumb your, omnipotent. Wow.
That's exactly what I did, because, and I really believed it with every fiber of my being that by me choosing to leave my home of origin to go live with my father, who was an atheist, that I was basically giving God an FU. And I was scared to death. But it got down to this. It was, I'm either going to die if I stay here, or I can leave and see if God will kill me as a result of leaving, because maybe he won't. Because that was the way I thought at the time. I don't think that way anymore, of course. But yeah, that's exactly what the stakes were like for me at that time.
So backing up again, just a little, I want to get back to this conversation, but what was this thing called? Like, did it have a name, or was it?
The Shepherding Movement.
The Shepherding Movement. Okay.
I've never heard of this before.
Well, like I said, it was one of the lesser sexy cults. And so it blended in fairly well, particularly in the Southern United States, which is, mm-hmm. as we all know, still very conservative in a lot of ways. And I'm down here in Dallas, Texas, guys. So I'm waving a flag over here going, is anybody listening?
I'm a Florida girl, so I feel you. I feel you, man.
I heard that the one star on the flag is the state's review.
That's good. That's clever.
I had like a follow up question, because you said that it was kind of in like small households, like a spread, like kind of like this underbelly, you know, in conservative Christian households. And how was there like a lot of homeschooling,
doing
the public school thing and stuff like that, and like the secular world is evil and bad. And
totally. Yeah. I was just about to bring that up. I was homeschooled, so that was when homeschooling became this really big deal in the 80s. And I was literally taught that dinosaurs were a hoax and they were planted there. The bones were planted there to, you know, trick us to determine whether or not our faith in God was bigger than the trick. And so, I mean, just kind of wackadoo stuff. And so, yeah, I was homeschooled in what would have been my freshman and sophomore year of high school. And that's when I became suicidal, because
when you left homeschooling and went to public school,
I was homeschooled for 2 years, and you don't go anywhere. You don't, no friends. Oh. I was a live-in, basically maid and nanny. And I had my full brother and two half brothers, all younger than me. And it got so bad at that point. And I had come forward telling the elders of the church, or telling my stepfather, my shepherd, that I had been sexually abused by an elder in the church. And they told me that basically, we don't believe you, and he's a man of God, and, you know, so forth and so on. And it was at that point when I couldn't, it was worth it to me to risk standing up to the God of the universe and leave.
God.
And stay. And so the point is, I mean, this, I don't tell these stories now because I'm like, oh, poor me or whatever. I'm way past all that. But the point is that this kind of insidious abuse of religion can happen right underneath everybody's noses. And so I had extended family, which the church had basically done a lot to sever our relationships with our extended family and so forth, but they tried to reach us, but we were too insulated.
And that was intentional. That isolation, insulation sounds 100% intentional.
Yes. I mean, I think they thought like Helen was saying, it was, you know, the big bad world out there. I write about it in my book. But it was the big bad world versus, you know, us.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. What? It sounds like this was how you were raised. Like. You were brought up to be the maid. You were brought up to be emotionally abused, and you were brought up to be a servant. How did you see past that? Like I don't want that for my life. I don't. This isn't how it should be. Like, how did that even occur to you? If it was just normal and how life was for you, how did it? How did it pass?
Yeah, the sliver there, I would describe it sometimes like living underneath a dark blanket, and you just have a pinhole that you can see through, and there's light on the other side. And so the pinhole of light that I had available to me was my dad, who was an atheist. And so when I left home, I went to go live with him, and I came up with a book title I haven't written yet, but one day I'm going to write it probably. And that's that I learned how to love when I quit being a Christian.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days. And now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.
Because my dad taught me to love people and to embrace people for who they are, and the diversity of humanity. And, you know, he was very just embracing of all different kinds of people in the 80s, when at that time it wasn't, you know, like the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
At the time, you know, he was totally cool with all that back then, which, you know, seems obvious to us now, but back then that was a big deal.
Yeah,
at least in Louisiana, it was.
Back in the 80s, I remember growing up amidst the satanic panic. And I also the panic that was brought about by the AIDS pandemic and the horrible propaganda that U.S. government and so many other religious organizations were spreading about HIV back then too. It was very scary, and so many believers were talking about it being the end times in the 80s for sure. But it's always the end times.
It always is, right? Yeah, totally.
Give me Morrow. So, so you were mentioning that like your childhood was very, very controlling. Like, you know, it was very misogynistic, you know, you're being brought up to be like a servant and stuff like that. So if you were going to like find a partner, get married, would your shepherd kind of pick your partner for you? Like, were women allowed to have a say in the person they were going to marry or something like that?
They would say that they let you make your own choice, but it was one of those, you know, clearly understood things that a person will tell you. Mm-hmm. Your shepherd would, you know, that's how my mother married my stepdad. You know, on the surface, really? She had the choice to marry him, but it was one of those deals where her shepherd, we were in Louisiana and he was in Florida, and the pastor of our home church in Louisiana and the pastor of the home church in Florida said, "Hey, I got a single guy. I got a single woman. God tells us that they should be connected." And then, you know, you know, to say no to what your shepherd suggests is not so cool. So even though they'll say you have the freedom to make that choice, you really don't. And so I grew up waiting. I thought life was going to end as soon as I turned 18, unless I had a husband in the wings. And so, and then I became a lesbian for 4 years anyway. So I spent my entire college experience just dating women, because I was like, fuck this shit. I'm not, you know.
Yeah.
And I really try not to use potty words all the time, but sometimes I get riled up about this subject. But that was I also consciously chose to date women in college because I had been taught to hate gay people when growing up, and I wanted to overcome that deeply rooted belief. So what better way to overcome something than to just dive right in? So that's what I did.
I experienced something similar. I didn't date men, but I sought out effeminate men to kind of be friends with. And I'll be honest with you, back in my teens, that was really scary for me. Like, because of what I was told and because of this this AIDS pandemic, I was very scared. But I pushed myself to get to know these people, and they're people. They're normal people. Surprise of all surprises, for crying out loud! It was damaging to be taught that stuff, but it was freeing to learn and find out what a lie it is.
I just want to acknowledge to Leah that I got the double entendre too, so I'm glad to see that somebody got it as well.
I got it. I was just being polite.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we're past being polite. My book is full of double entendres, so that's cool.
As a bi woman, I got it. I totally got it. Because I did the same thing when I was growing up. Like, I grew up Catholic, and then somewhere in my late teens, early 20s, I started diving in, and I never looked back. So,
yeah.
But I would like to just point out, because I was noticing what time it is, I do want to point out though that what's most important to me, and like the work that I'm doing with American Nun and some other work that I'm doing, is I'm happy to talk about cults, and I am happy to talk. I hope so desperately to help others, just like Recovering from Religion is doing, help others heal. But it's the solution that I think is where the focus needs to be. You know, when we have been raised these ways, I love to live in the solution. And to me, the solution is, honestly, it's that Norman Rockwell painting right behind me. And even though it is attributed to the Bible, it's a notion that's in just about every major religion. And that's just, you treat people the way you want to be treated, with kindness and respect and so forth. And so I don't harbor anger or resentment toward religious people or even religion, but I do stand up strongly against the abuse of religion. And that I feel is something worth us all harbor. Yes, harbor.
It's another damn boat pun for
crying. Oh, okay. We're doing more boat puns. Yeah. Listen, if I would have known boat puns was going to be a theme, I could have dug in a little bit there, but
I'm really hoping it wouldn't come up again. This arm, like, I was hoping people would have forgotten about the boat puns and we could have moved.
Have you met us, Eric? Have you met
us? Rachel, yeah,
please tell us more about like American Nun and what you do over there. Like, we would, I think that'd be really beneficial for a lot of the people to know what other activists and stuff are doing in the community.
At this point, it's just about building community and participating in some of the online conversation that's happening, particularly in social media and on Instagram, just trying to get some conversations started, but just participate in a broader conversation with people who are going through what's called deconstruction. So probably most of the people on this call tonight, most of us are already very comfortable in our own space and where we are in terms of our orientation to reality and the world and so forth. But there are masses of Americans who are leaving organized religion and going through what's called deconstruction, where they're just trying to process, you know, what they were taught. And the problem is it's conflicting, because for some people, if you weren't raised in a cult, you actually may have some warm feelings about a lot of the things that you were taught or the things you experienced. And so it gets confusing when you're trying to parse out, you know, what was worth keeping, what do I need to get rid of? And so anyway, American Nun right now is just participating in that community and just trying to provide a safe space for conversation.
Yeah, a lot of the people here on the call, and a lot of people who view this this video or listen to this podcast, they aren't necessarily out and secure. A lot, that's what people come to RFR for, is they have doubts. They're in the beginning throes of transitioning out of religion, or they're just confused and have some questions. And so the American Nuns, from how you're describing it, sounds perfect for a lot of the folks who come to RFR and can hear the sound of our voices.
Yeah, we're on most of the social media platforms at American Nun. So
what are your future, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
What are your future plans with American Nun? It sounds like it's just kind of beginning in its nascent state.
It definitely is. So right now I'm building a community through American Nun, just to facilitate communication. But I'm also working on kind of a sister project to that called Love is Greater. And because the tagline for American Nun is Love is Greater Than Labels. And the whole idea is that what I'm trying to advance is this notion that it's not whether or not you call yourself a Christian or an atheist or a Hindu or a Scientologist or whatever. It's how you live and how you treat people and whether or not you're a good steward of this life that we're given. And so the Love is Greater is, I haven't published the website yet, but it's loveisgreater.world. And it's going to be a content and merchandise company that will take proceeds, and it's a for-profit business so that I can make money to turn around and give to a variety of different nonprofits.
So it sounds like, based on your own past and growing up in the shepherding movement, that this is a big passion for you, and it's even somewhat personal. It's just not something like, oh yeah, Bitcoin, I can invest in that. But this is really, really much more passionate, the passion of yours.
Oh, definitely. It's definitely a deep passion. And it's because I have seen such suffering from so many people. I just, here in Dallas alone, I know so many women who've gone to a bunch of these big mega churches, and they've been shamed into staying into abusive marriages just because, you know, it's the biblical thing or whatever to stay with your husband. And meanwhile, they're being really abused. And that's just one example, but I've just seen too much suffering done in the name of religion or the name of God. And I want to do whatever I can to try to reverse. I guess in a way it's similar to when I stood up to that concept of God when I was 16. And I said, I got to get out of here, even though I'm scared to death. And I did it. And that's kind of how I feel now in a way, because I'm standing up to a cultural force, and I'm saying, you know what, just shoot me if I'm wrong, but what's going on out there in the ways that we've been talking about tonight is not okay.
I love it. I absolutely love it. With it being so new, what can folks like myself, what's available for folks like myself on through American Nuns?
Right now, American Nun is truly just an online community. So you can follow us on Instagram or Twitter. If in you're right, it is definitely in its infancy stages. But just joining the online community, or I also on my personal Instagram page, I get a little bit more personal on my Instagram page than I do on American Nun. And that's Rachel_L_Roberts. I've got
those posted in the chat.
Oh, okay.
In the YouTube description as well. I need to put them over on the Atheist Community Discord too. I'll drop them over there.
So I just, at this point, it's just a matter of fostering communication, but shortly, within a few weeks, I'll be launching loveisgreater.world. And this is where I want to dismantle the labels that we attribute to ourselves, and just try to bring us to a place of reconciliation. And another book I want to write is Love is Like Porn, because do you guys know that quote from, I think it was in the 70s, the Supreme Court justice who was being tasked to define pornography. Do you guys remember that? Yeah, when I see it, I know it. It's and so, you know, because it is, it's hard to find the line between porn and just like, you know, naked Italian art or whatever. Love is like corn. Oh, that's funny. I probably could come up with something about that too, but
there might be a kernel of truth in there.
Oh, now you're gonna have corn puns.
Your love fills my cornhole.
Oh, good. I got off the boat theme. We can now
have corn puns.
Oh, gosh, yeah. So, but anyway, you know, it doesn't matter if we're in a different country, you don't know the language. If it's music and you don't know the language, you know love when you experience it. And so that's part of what Love is Grant cornhub.com.
Awesome. Oh my God.
So loveisgreater.world will be a content and merchandise company that will then, the, like I said, the whole point is to make money so that it can be given away to other nonprofits that are doing, that are living love in the world.
So what would you,
Oh boy, this is, oh, I'm sorry. See, now I'm reading, now I'm distracted. Corn buns.
Corn buns.
Oh my God.
Oh my gosh. This is hilarious.
I'm telling you, we have a fantastic audience. They're just, they're so great. I love them. I have to read the chat, but sometimes I don't want to, but they're just so brilliant.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
They're just stalking us with with all the puns.
You mentioned Star Trek in your bio. Was that something that you watched quite often in the 1980s? And did that have an effect on kind of how you saw the world, like grew up and came out of this cult?
It did. It did considerably, actually, because, oh my gosh! That's the best one.
Yeah, yeah. I know.
How many of these jokes are going to be?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. Oh my gosh. Oh, Lord have mercy. Okay.
I think we are going to set up a second show from Recovering from Religion, and it'll just be all puns. It'll just be 100% puns, and we can goof off and dad jokes. God.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So back to Star Trek. Yeah, my dad actually is the one that instilled my love for Star Trek in me, and we would watch Next Generation. I watched the original series when I was little bitty. But then I basically kind of came of age on Next Generation, and just some of the themes that were dealt with in some of those shows really just, it made me want to live then, you know. I was like, I want to be on the Enterprise, but pop culture was very important in giving me a sliver of a sense that there's a different way of understanding the world, you know, other than the way that I knew it growing up. And the way that Star Trek was egalitarian and just, you know, intelligent, because that was the other thing. I didn't realize, I literally was taught by my stepfather that it was evil to use my mind, that, and I am an intellectual by nature. So it was, I didn't know it as a kid, because I was the one that would ask all those questions, you know, like, well, what about the people in Africa that have never heard of Jesus? Are they going to go to hell too, mommy? You know, and then she'd give me some, you know, pat answer that wouldn't satisfy. And so Star Trek kind of helped me find a space where I felt I belonged, I guess.
I love it. I felt the same way too, kind of growing up. In some sense, it gave me a Pollyanna view of the world, but in another sense,
the rat of corn. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. That was so rude of me. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Eric.
It's
I'm not fine. See, I'm gonna close the chat. I need it. I'm
as chap, the chatters are funny, intelligent people, and they're just like, you give them an inch and they're going to take a mile.
Sometimes the chat can be a tassel, you know, it's just so much. Anyways, so the Star Trek Next Generation for me was something very similar to you. It, in some sense, I had like this Pollyanna view of the world where it's all unicorns and rainbows. But when reality would kind of come at me, Star Trek instead became more of a goal. Like, hey, they wrote this, we can achieve this. Let's give it a shot.
Yeah, you know, I wrote a paper my freshman year of college called When Men Wear Skirts. And at the time, that was a really radical notion that a man might wear a skirt in public in the United States. Mm. But the point of the paper was, we'll know that we've reached some type of equality when a man can wear a skirt walking down the street and nobody thinks anything of it, because we've been hearing, you know, women had been, you know, beating the drum for decades. And I'm not suggesting we've arrived, because you never really arrive, I don't think. But I didn't think, going back to your point of, you know, if they do it in Star Trek, why can't we do it now? In this lifetime. And I would have never guessed when I wrote that paper my freshman year of college that we would be in the space where we are now, where, you know, gay marriage is legal and non-binary, you know, people are being treated with respect, at least in portions of the country, maybe not in Texas, I don't know, but you know what I mean. But so yeah, it was very idealistic like that, but in a positive way.
Yeah, I still have really fond memories of Star Trek, and I freaking love it. And I've always seen science fiction as like humanity's wish list in some sense. Like reading Isaac Asimov's works, and it's also, science fiction can be like a warning as well, right, to like 1984 and Fahrenheit 451, things like that. Yeah. I feel so derailed from this amazing, these amazing pun corns, corn puns.
Corn.
Pun corns.
Pun corns.
Yeah. So Rachel, what do you want to talk about next? I'll move transfer the onus to you.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
Who is your favorite character on, I'm going to do all the Star Treks. Who is your favorite character of all time of all the Star Treks?
Oh my goodness. Oh man, that's a great, I had a mad crush on Jean-Luc.
Did you really?
I had a mad crush. I still have a mad crush on Jean-Luc. Yeah. Oh, I never went away.
Yeah. I was like 16, you know, fawning over Jean-Luc. I don't know what that says about me. Maybe I have daddy issues. I don't know.
You just like a sexy bald man.
But I don't know. I mean, Jean-Luc is, I really like Jean-Luc, but I don't know. I've never really nailed it down to one, I don't think. So say that I can answer that. I'm sorry. That's a little overwhelming.
It's a deep philosophical question.
Yeah, I know, that's the thing. In my mind, I'm like trying to think through like all these different facets of the different characters, and well, what would I pick ultimately? So I'll tell you who kind of annoyed me, though, to be honest, was Deanna Troi. Like, she
what?
Was...
What? Yeah. She had very vague powers, so...
I think she was... Sometimes she was just a little too touchy-feely for me. So, sometimes that just, you know... But she didn't annoy me as much as Tasha Yar.
Tasha annoyed you?
Did you like Tasha Yar? Like,
yes!
I loved it when Worf entered the picture. Worf was like, it was awesome.
All right. My favorite, or Helen, who was your favorite? We're just devolving. Who's your favorite character?
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, we've lost half the audience. Because
I know. I'm looking at the numbers and it's dropping precipitously.
I'm trying to think. I think.
Well, my favorite character. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
We just did a rewatch of TNG not long ago. And like, I don't know, like when I was younger, it was Troi. And then like watching it as an adult, like I kind of agree with Rachel. She kind of got my nerves. And I kind of really fell in love with Data again, because he was like this really intellectual little kid, you know, that just wanted to experience everything about being human. And I found that really charming. So I kind of really identified with dated this time around, even though I'm in, you know, my 40s now and stuff like that, like this wonderment of the human experience, which I found like really inspiring in a way, like my the second watch that I did and stuff like that. But if I'm gonna go like classic Trek, I'm gonna go with Spock. So like Spock, like over everything and stuff like that. So like the later ones, like Deep Space Nine and stuff like that, I don't really have a favorite character. I kind of like, I watched them, but I wasn't as engaged with those as like my the original series in TNG, which I fell in love with. So I'm a, you know, I know I'm biased, it's fine.
I know the answer to your question.
Okay,
it's the Discovery, the what was
Michael Burnham?
Not Michael. Stamets? I mean, Oscar, but the lady, what's her name? Because it's been a while.
I don't know. There's a lot of ladies.
I know.
The Asian lady.
Michelle Yeoh.
The one that was like a nice captain and became an evil captain. Yes, and yes. Yeah, I know you're talking about. Yeah, she's a badass. I love her.
Yeah. I like her. She's my favorite.
Yeah, she's great.
She was the Empress.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
I like her.
Yeah, she's a badass. Right. I love her too.
I'm gonna pull this back on track a little bit.
Okay, sorry. So you get a bunch of nerds together. This is what happens, Derek.
I really want to have this conversation too. I really like. I'm geeking out as well, but
I actually see a question here that looks legit.
Yes, that's what I was going to.
It's not about corn or Star Trek, but the problem is I don't have my glasses on. Wait, come on.
It's fine. So Rachel, what I've experienced with the secular community, it's like herding cats. When we come out of religion, having been told how to live, told what to do, told what to eat, told who to love and who not to love, and then we get out of religion, we want to completely reject almost any form of leadership. Now, I'm not talking about everyone. This has been my experience for a lot of, just with a lot of people and secular communities. Have you seen that? And if so, how do you, what's the plan to kind of address that in American Nuns?
That's actually a fabulous question. And that's one of the reasons why I'm launching loveisgreater.world, because the facilitation of conversation needs to be just simply what people who want to be there to participate. And it is sometimes hard to find a rally cry or a unifying message, I guess, because when people have had kind of some disparate experiences and they all land in somewhat different places on the other side in many ways. But that's where I realized that most people can agree that if we're simply loving to one another. Now, I know I'm smart enough to know we have to define what love is, and that can be defined in a lot of different ways. And the word love can be misused and abused, just like the word God. So I'm not naive to that. But truly, I do believe with all my heart and mind, because I've been studying this for many years, that the experience of love between humans transcends all these limitations. So if we can have the conversation around that, then I think that's something that can at least allow more people to come to the table together than having it be a division between whether you're religious or not religious or what you call yourself and all that. And the other thing is, honestly, Eric, in a very pragmatic way, if I had the budget, I do think that a savvy marketing campaign would help people realize, basically come out of the closet, because I parallel what's happening today with the defection from organized religion to what was happening in the LGBTQ communities back in the 60s, 70s, and then coming to kind of its apex in the late 80s when the AIDS epidemic, you know, forced it to be so. Where now people, it's like, they know they're not really religious, but they don't really want to come out of the closet yet. it's not totally a safe kosher thing to do, at least in a lot of circles, mm-hmm. a lot of places. And so, you know, if I'm down here trying to launch this organization in Dallas, and I do think that if I had the funds, I do think that people would resonate. Like, I have a quiz on the website, AmericanNun.com, where you can take a quiz to find out if you're a nun. And if that got in front of more people, I think they would feel more empowered to say, hey, this is who I am and it's okay. And once you realize you're not alone, then you're more prone to find community. Because how many LGBTQ people had community, really like rich, extensive community prior to the last, you know, few decades? They were afraid.
Yeah. Not here in the US, I would imagine.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I have a similar feeling as kind of what your observation is, that we're the nuns are close to hitting this tipping point. It's a snowballing effect, and more people are realizing that they don't believe in what their parents and what their grandparents and great grandparents have taught and believed all that time. And it might be this great awakening that's eventually going to happen within our lifetime, I hope. And again, that might be Star Trek Pollyanna thinking, but I am seeing the same similarities matches that you're kind of describing as well.
Well, part of what I'm hoping too is that one of my long-term, this is definitely a long-term objective with American Nun, is to normalize being non-religious, but do it in a loving way. Because unfortunately, the atheist movement from the 20th century had some bad PR. And it's just maybe because of a few people with some megaphones, but it put a bad taste in the rest of the public's mouth about, you know, who atheists were. So there were all these misnomers about what it means to not believe in God, and wasn't fair. Does that make sense? I mean, you know the stereotype, and I'm not saying that is a fair blanket statement at all. I'm just saying that if we can normalize being non-religious, but do it in a very loving way, that'll go a lot farther with more people than, you know, being antagonistic and things like that.
I think like especially with the new atheist movement that happened in like the 2010s and stuff like that, right. it was very male dominated, antagonistic, yeah. You know, calling religious people dumb for, you know, believing in like sky gods and whatever their beliefs were, right. And stuff like that. And I understand that a lot of that came from like this anger place, you know, and maybe like a little bit of trauma, and also to get clout, you know. And like me as an activist, like I'm always saying, like, the biggest message we have to get out there as non-religious people is to be compassionate. You know, you're not going to win anybody over to their, to your side by yelling at them, by demanding they think the way that you do. What you want to do is show that, like, I'm just a person and I care about you and I want you to be happy. I just don't hold a God belief. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you can get over to where I am and see the world for what it is and not that you, what you want to be, and accept that other people are just people, you're going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And you'll find wonderful people that will love you for you. And I think that's a really important message, like you and Eric and me and everybody else that are working to make this world a better place for non-religious people, is to help bring people over to our side by using that compassion. I think that's a really important message that you're getting out there, Rachel, and it needs to be heard more.
Well, thank you. And I same with what you guys are doing. I mean, it's just so, nobody is motivated by insult and shame and anger. And so, you know, and I, because there was a time in my life where I really did believe a lot of these, you know, the religious stuff. Because I returned to religion for a time in my adulthood too, a different form of Christianity, but nonetheless, I experienced it as an adult as well. And so I understand both sides. You know, I see people who really believe these things, and some of these people who believe that Jesus literally rose from the dead are some of the most highly intelligent people that I know, and loving, compassionate human beings. And I'm like, how can you be a neurosurgeon and believe Jesus's body rose from the dead? I don't get it. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if they're kind, loving people who serve humanity. And so there's just something to parse there. Somebody asked, what made you decide to try Christianity again? Thank you for the question. The reason I did was because I had been so traumatized by religion for my entire childhood. And then when I studied philosophy of religion in my undergraduate work, I learned about Jesus as basically a social justice activist. And so I was captivated by that Jesus. And I ended up going to the seminary here at SMU, which is a very progressive seminary. And it was a place where, you know, they told you the truth about the Bible. Like, it's full of all kinds of flaws, and it's been, you know, it's not just God said it and that's it. You know, I mean, it was like academic work. It was an academic study of theology. And honestly, those were some of the most wonderful human beings I've ever known were from that seminary. But at the end of the day, I still noticed some double speak in church. And also I felt like an imposter because I've studied from Buddhism and Taoism, and I love science, and I love to learn from all different sources. And so I didn't feel comfortable calling myself a Christian. And in fact, one of my dirty secrets is that I taught Buddhism in the Christian church, and I just used Jesus language. And they loved it.
It's like yoga, having yoga, calling it CrossFit or cross stretching or something like that.
Yeah.
In the church.
No, but I did. I taught some Buddhist principles because there's some similarities between some things Buddha taught and Jesus. And anyway, but it was cool. I like what somebody just wrote. That's my goal, not to be an imposter ever again. And amen to that. That's why I left religion altogether several years ago, was because there was a disconnect. My personal integrity felt compromised.
Yeah. You know, and let's not forget too, we are coming, and it's still very active, but especially in the height of the 1980s with the Satanic Panic, there was, for thousands of years, there's been an active smear campaign against folks who don't believe in the Christian God. In the support group, so many of the stories I hear is people moving from one religion to another because they don't even think of being an atheist or an agnostic as being something that's moral and just and ethical, because atheists eat babies, atheists sacrifice cows and children and goats or whatever. It's completely understandable for folks with that, who have been taught that, to not even think about going in that direction until it seems like the last straw, and where nothing is, this God is no longer real.
They murder corn, according to Kara.
We had another great question. Were you able to ever reconcile with your mother and your stepfather? If that's too personal, don't, you know.
Oh, no. Listen, I told all my dirty secrets in here. I have nothing to hide. I forgave my stepfather, reconciled with, they divorced, by the way, because when I left, that was the very beginning of the whole thing crumbling, that like the entire shepherding movement just fell apart within like.
Oh, so it's no longer, the shepherding movement is no longer around.
No, it disbanded in the early 90s.
Was it like an internal issue, or were they sued? Like,
It would not surprise me if there were lawsuits involved, but I don't personally know of them. I do know that at least a couple of the Fort Lauderdale Five that I referenced earlier wrote public apologies because they basically fessed up to the idea that we thought we were doing a good thing, and then it turned into a system of abuse. Anyway, I wouldn't say that I reconciled with my stepfather in the sense that I don't have any kind of relationship with him, but I definitely forgave him. And so there's that. And then when I wrote this book, I write about him. I don't use his name, of course. I made a decision to myself, am I going to write this book and speak my truth, for fear, but have fear that it's going to offend, you know, my half brothers, that he is their father, for example, or other people that I know that know him and all this. And then I finally decided, you know what, I'm not smearing. I'm just telling my story. I didn't use his name. And I refuse to be complicit in the propagation of further abuse, period. And it was like, until people start speaking up, nothing's going to ever change. And so the Me Too movement and all that stuff, you know, even though those movements can have their own tendrils that aren't always positive, but I just decided that's one of the positive things of social media, is that you can use your voice in a good way if you so choose.
Yeah. And it sounds like you forgiving your stepfather was more about you and what you needed at the time, as opposed to anything that have to do with him or your mother.
Funny thing is, he's never once come to me and asked me to forgive him. And I've seen him every now and then over the years. I've seen him because I have two brothers by him. Mm-hmm. But one time I told him I forgave him. And it was very powerful for me because, you know, it's not like he requested it, but it was a way of me taking my power to be able to sit across the table from him and tell him I forgive you, even though he didn't ask for it. But it was very, very useful for me. And then with my mother, yes, I definitely have reconciled with her. And we kind of have a don't ask, don't tell type relationship when it comes to matters of religion and so forth.
And you may or may not have a lot of acquaintances that were back from those days or from your Christian days. But I would imagine being in Dallas alone, there's quite a few people you meet who might ask you, hey, why don't you come visit my church? How do you kind of handle that?
I want to answer your question, but I also want to answer a question that was posed here in the chat. So I'll answer your question first. Okay. But I just don't want to forget to get to this question about forgiveness. I just generally say no, thank you. And then if somebody keeps pushing, then I'll just tell them. I mean, I've gotten when you write a book and you put it out there,
yep.
you know, it's like, listen, I've already done all the hard work. So if you can't, you know, take the heat, then, but I'm never ugly to somebody unless they're being like really antagonistic. I'm not ugly to people. But I have no problem being firm.
What was the question? Yeah.
The question was forgiveness. Let's see here.
Forgiveness is a big part of Christianity. How do you think about the concept of forgiveness now that you are not thinking in religious terms anymore?
Yeah, I love that question. And I personally don't think of forgiveness as being something that's unique to religion. I think that we associate it that way just because that's been the primary vehicle in which it's been taught in our culture. But it's an internal exercise that I think behooves all people to be able to do when it's called for. And what I mean by forgiveness is ultimately seeing the humanity, the shared humanity in the other person. My mother used to say to me, hurt people, and I don't think that's an excuse for just anybody to do anything because they, you know, had a bad childhood or whatever. But when you see the humanity in other people and when you can recognize your own complicated nature of yourself, it helps you level the playing field. That's, for me, that's the beginning place, but it ultimately is just a matter of releasing whatever grip that issue or that person has on your psyche, your heart, your mind, however you want to quantify it.
One of my therapists said to me that forgiveness is the long held breath and letting it go.
That's a great way to, that's beautiful.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's and great. It's always something that kind of stuck with me, you know, that I'm holding on to something that isn't serving me anymore. And forgiveness is just letting it go. You know, I'm not going to let this anger, this tension and this these feelings hold me anymore, and I'm just gonna let it go and just release it,
that's exactly right. And I also think that with forgiveness, when it comes down to it, like, my stepfather wasn't abusing me. Mm-hmm. He was an abuser. In other words, it could have been anybody that would have been me would have received that. Mm-hmm. So when I start to understand who I am and my own sense of agency and my own sense of power, then I realize that what that person did to me was not done to me, if that makes any sense.
Right.
Whatever you did is actually a reflection of you. And so that's when you take that energy, that god-awful energy that was, you know, thrust upon you or just, you know, leveled upon you, and you turn it around and you go, bam, I'm giving that back to you. That is not my shit to own.
Right.
And so that goes back to what I was saying about understanding the humanity. When I came to understand who I am, then I was free. It was a release.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Rachel, I think this has been one of the more unique talks. I'll be perfectly honest, and there's
awesome. A quickness
to that. I love it. Before we we've already kind of gone through the Q&A session too with really glad you were following along with the chat, but before we kind of sign off, do you have any final thoughts or anything you wanted to say that we haven't really covered?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is I want to be friends with you guys because this was fun.
You know, right?
You're so awesome. I want to be friends with you too, Rachel.
Friends. Yeah. I don't know that it's like I have so many thoughts and yet if I were to boil it down to one, I just honestly, the main thing I'm thinking at the moment is just how grateful I am that your group exists. And it was so inspiring to me to see so many people who joined the call tonight. And we never talked about my bad perm. But I guess that wasn't a pressing issue for everybody because I didn't see any questions in there about my perm. But I have a feeling I'm not the only perm survivor from the 80s that was on the call tonight. So
You know, and folks, if you follow her Instagram, I think that she shares or has recently shared some of those pictures. If like you were kind of showing us before the show started.
So anyway, thank you for everything that all of you are doing. And I wish that I think there were some more questions in the chat that we were too busy talking about corn and Star Trek.
Those are the important topics.
Look, I love puns. I really do. But when you're, when I'm trying to like be serious and think about it, it's just, it's like this battle is in, like you want to participate really bad too, but no, you also have to be a responsible adult. And but, all right, it's great. I love it. Helen, do you have any final thoughts as well? Anything that you didn't ask or want to know?
I just found this talk really, like, I didn't know what the Shepherd's Movement was, so I learned something new about a new weird cult that I didn't know existed, because every time, like, whatever, sometimes, like, when we do these talks, somebody will throw out something, I'm like, I didn't know that existed. That was terrible, and I'm sorry, that's what usually happens. Somebody says something, and I'm like, that was a terrible thing that happened to you that I didn't know existed, and I am very sorry, and I'm just, it's like one of those things that I'm constantly amazed by, like, this dark underbelly of religion, because we always hear about like the big ones, you know, right, and all the awful shit they do. And then there's all these like little cults and bad shit that's going on in like middle America that we don't know what's going on. So it's always one of those things that I'm like, well, I learned some awful things today. But usually the speaker also, like, your story is really inspiring that you got out and you became this intelligent, beautiful, thoughtful, kind person that wants to go out and bring people together, you know, and live in a more loving, open world. And I think that's a very inspiring story that people should, you know, that they should feel, you know, inspired by and wanting to get out there and be better people. And that's the world that we want to see is going to happen. So, you know, that's what I got out of it, you know.
Well, we're all in this together. So
yeah,
I love that. Thank you so much, Rachel.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.